I'll ask Ms. Johnson or Marshall to call the next case for hearing. Oh, I will call the case for hearing. We're ready to address Mark Kadrowski, petitioner, versus Masako Kadrowski as a respondent. Council, go ahead and set yourselves up. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your primary argument. An additional 5 minutes is reserved to you, appellant counsel, for rebuttal if you choose to use that. When you are ready to proceed, you should approach the podium and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of for our record purposes. The podium does have a switch if you need to make it higher or make it lower depending on your particular needs. And when you're ready to proceed, you may do so.
Morning. May I please the court? My name is Kevin Sandstrom. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant Mark Kadrowski in this matter. And as the court is well aware, I think there's a fairly narrow set of issues before the court in this circumstance, the primary issue being whether or not my client's maintenance obligation should have been terminated in pursuant to a motion brought in 2017. And this certainly is an unfortunate set of circumstances, as I think was referenced by the trial court judge in his order that was issued in April of 2018 on these issues. The short of it being, my client was the owner of this business, Blue Earth, that was part of the original divorce decree. And then subsequent to that decree, he ultimately ended up giving that to his second wife as part of a second divorce matter in 2000, which was terminated in late 2016.
Counsel, I think that we're probably all familiar with the facts.
Sure.
I have one question that is looming at the forefront of my mind.
Great. Let's hear it.
Your client was in a plane crash in 2010.
Right.
His first marriage was dissolved in 2012, if I understand that.
Correct. Yes.
One thing I noted, I don't think there's anything unless I missed it in the judgment and decree related to the first dissolution about the plane crash. Did I miss that?
Not specifically about the plane crash that I recall, although it obviously was not, I think, an issue of dispute in that matter. And
okay.
The reality being, he still owned the business and was still collecting income from that business. And so he stipulated as part of, and that was a stipulated judgment decree, obviously, in that scenario.
All right, so I don't think there's anything in there that actually refers to the plane crash. But what there is in the 2012 judgment and decree is a statement based on the party stipulation that your client was in good health and was capable of being self-supporting. And he claimed he waived any claim to past, present, or future maintenance. And he had the ability to meet his needs and also the ability to support his then wife,
right.
Ex-wife.
Soon to be ex-wife. Yes.
Now we have several years have passed, and we have facts before us that suggest, and in particular in your brief on page 6 at the bottom, an expert who is opining that your client's combined physical, cognitive, executive function, emotional deficits, lack of stamina, render him incapable of constructive work even in a low-level sheltered workshop position. And there's evidence in the record that your client needs supervision to make sure that he gets to his doctor's appointments. And I mean, a very, very sad, tragic description
right.
of his circumstances. And I'm wondering two things. Given his intellectual cognitive impairment, why no guardian ad litem was appointed for him in his current divorce, if you know. And secondly, why would he have waived spousal maintenance in his current marriage dissolution if he is incapable of even working in a low-level sheltered workshop position? So those are my two questions.
Those are good questions, and I'm not sure I have good answers for them. And in part, I was not counsel of record for Mr. Kedrowski during those proceedings. For example, in the 2012 divorce proceeding, I'm not sure why the stipulated divorce decree says he was in good health.
Because he signed the stipulation. I don't know why it does either. Okay, so you can't answer that.
I can't answer those things.
And you weren't the lawyer in his current marriage dissolution, is that correct?
I was not. I'm here as his appeals for purposes of this appeal entirely. So I was not.
But you're familiar with that record.
I am very familiar with it. And I think a lot of this expert testimony and reports and whatnot really were developed in his personal injury action that the court certainly has seen reference to.
Well, it still begs the question, in terms of credibility and how we look at all this evidence, is that if he is incapable of even working in a supervised shelter setting, why he would have waived spousal maintenance. I'm just telling you, it's a question in my mind, but you can't answer the question. I understand why.
And for purposes of the second divorce action, I'm not sure why it was waived, and frankly, it may have not been a good idea for him to waive that, but I also am not sure that it's necessarily pertinent to the issue of determining whether he's entitled to terminate his spousal maintenance obligation dating back to his first dissolution, which is what we're here to discuss today. And so I'm sorry I don't have good answers for why that was done as a strategy matter or a matter of fact, because I don't think there's an issue of credibility regarding my client's disabilities. I mean, he's receiving Social Security disability. He's receiving long-term disability benefits from an insurance policy. He's clearly disabled. There's replete evidence in his medical records, as well as from experts in that other case involving the great level of disability that he has. And so and I don't think there was any dispute in the motion that he brought regarding termination of spousal maintenance that there was any credibility as to whether or not he had these disabilities and had serious medical issues. That the findings in the order when he sought to terminate spousal maintenance, there was no finding that he was faking his disabilities or that he didn't suffer from serious physical or mental disabilities. That's not an issue that's noted in the findings of fact at all from the trial court's level. In terms of this motion to terminate spousal maintenance, the issue is really, I mean, the trial court acknowledges in terms of this motion that there is a substantial change in circumstances in terms of his loss of employment, and there's certainly discussion back and forth in the briefing regarding, is there bad faith here in relation to the fact that he gave up his interest in this business? And what we've pointed out in our briefing, there is no express finding of bad faith. There's no particular findings that would demonstrate why his sale of the business was bad faith, and in fact, the court outright says, I can't make a finding of bad faith. I'm not sure if it's just unfortunate circumstances, but the reality is the court says there's just inequities, and it's not really clear what those inequities are from the trial court's perspective, but I think the primary error here is the fact that the trial court specifically includes in discussing my client's income the fact that he's receiving property settlement payments from the sale of this business to his second wife.
Mr. Sandstrom, would there need to be bad faith pursuant to the Beck case, and that's part of the argument respondent makes, that this very accident and the conditions was known at the time of the stipulation such that it would be anticipated the exact scenario that resulted in the sale?
I think a specific finding of bad faith on the part of my client in terms of an intentional under production of employment or income would certainly be helpful to the respondents situation or their arguments, and that certainly wasn't the case here. There wasn't findings in that regard. But in terms of the anticipation argument that they make in their briefs, I've read the Beck case, and the Beck case I don't think is necessarily on point in terms of the factual scenario in that case. And I don't think the situation was anticipated here. My client didn't want to give up his business, and the reality being here, it doesn't make any sense. The respondent's argument on this situation should have been anticipated, or somehow he's complicit in the issue, just simply doesn't make sense. That my client voluntarily and in some manner of bad faith or poor planning gave up a business and a job that was earning him $150,000 a year simply to avoid an $1,800 a month maintenance obligation. That's certainly not the case, that he did this on purpose for some form or fashion to avoid paying maintenance, because he was certainly earning far more income from that business than what he paid in maintenance. So why would he give that up to spite his ex-wife? It just doesn't make sense. And the reality being, there is no finding or showing of bad faith in this scenario.
Would he need to do it for any bad reason so much as he anticipated, because he already knew his medical condition at the time of the stipulation, that was a very likely scenario that he no longer could operate the business? Isn't that really what the Beck decision would stand for?
Well, the Beck decision talks about at the time of a dissolution, there was a stipulated divorce decree, and the recipient of spousal maintenance did not include in that divorce decree any provisions for cost of living increases. In the Beck case says, well, when you didn't, you should have foresaw that you might need cost of living increases over time, and if you didn't incorporate that into your dissolution paperwork, you forego that later on, because that's kind of common sense and anticipated that you might need an increase in cost of living over time. Certainly in this case, my client's physical and mental injuries were known. But that's not the dispute here, and that's not what anyone, I think, would argue he should have anticipated. He knew he had these disabilities. What wasn't anticipated was the fact that he'd basically slowly over time lose control of his business by the fact he just wasn't around. An absent CEO doesn't make for a very strong leader in a company of this sort. And he couldn't anticipate, secondly, that he puts a trusted person in his place to help run the business, his new wife, Jerry Kudrowski. And I don't think he can reasonably be expected to anticipate that marriage is going to fall apart as well, and then that's going to force him to give up that business. I don't think it's fair that Mr. Kudrowski should have to be omniscient and prophetic in predicting the future, that his second divorce is going to end, or his second marriage is going to end in divorce 4 or 5 years later after it's been entered into. I don't think that's what the Beck case stands for, that hindsight's always 20/20, but should he really have predicted that in advance in 2012 when he engages in that marriage, or when he's figuring out what to do with his business and entering into an expected payment of spousal maintenance? I really don't think that's a reasonable thing for him to have anticipated. But the other issue here is that was not even an issue. That anticipation of this condition or this turn of events was not even an argument that was argued by the respondent at the trial court level. And so whether or not this issue was anticipated, frankly, was never brought before the trial court. And so it's not really an appropriate issue to even be discussing at this level, because I think there was... So what the respondent is now trying to argue, that there wasn't a substantial change in circumstances because this should have been anticipated. But there's already a finding at the trial court level that there was a substantial change in circumstances, and there was no argument about whether or not there's a lack of change in substantial circumstances because it should have been anticipated. So where the respondent's argument on appeal fails is they didn't raise that issue at the trial court level, and there's already expressed findings by the trial court that the loss of the business is a substantial change in circumstances. And so I think the real issue here is, was it appropriate for the trial court to include those periodic monthly property settlement payments as income? Because when you take that property settlement out of the equation, the reality is Mr. Kudrowski only has $4,300 a month in income, and he's also obligated to pay child support to the respondent already, and that's not a disputed issue in this case. And so you take his $4,300 in actual income, his actual disability income, you subtract out his child support payment, which is almost $1,700 a month, and you add that into the income that the respondent's receiving as laid out in finding of fact number 10 in the court's order. The respondent is receiving, absent any spousal maintenance, $4,123 a month. And my client, after subtracting out child support, is receiving more in the order of $2,600 a month. And so that's before spousal maintenance is even considered. And so the part that's baffling here is how the trial court could find there's some sort of inequity or an unfairness in this scenario where just based upon the actual income, the true monthly income as is appropriately calculated from my client and the respondent, and then factoring in the child support shift, the respondents are getting far more income each month than my client is. And my client, if he's required to continue paying spousal maintenance on top of that, is left with a mere $900 to support himself each month out of his actual income. And so how can you not find that spousal maintenance should be terminated in that scenario where, in that scenario, if spousal maintenance has continued to be paid, the respondent is getting upwards of $6,000 a month in income where my client is left with $900. It just doesn't make sense. And so that property settlement payment is critical to this issue because it's clear that the trial court had to have included that in income and did so inappropriately under the case law. And that's really an error of law because the law is clear that property settlements, you can't be expected to dip into assets and property settlements to pay spousal maintenance. It's an issue of law that's well established, and I don't think the respondents have provided anything to the contrary. And I see my time's up, and I'll reserve any further comment for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Sandstrom. Respondent counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Linda DeBeer, appearing on behalf of Masako Kodrowski. May it please the court. The standard of review is always very important in cases at the appellate level, but here it's determinative because the trial court, as we know, is given broad discretion to decide spousal maintenance issues, and we defer to their findings of fact, and their order must be construed in the light most favorable to affirming it. That said, before I get into the argument I had planned for you, I want to answer some of the questions that were already raised. Our firm has been counsel for Ms. Kodrowski since the beginning of the case. Mr. Sandstrom may not have been involved in the earlier motions, but his colleague at the same firm, Mark Vierling, came onto the case in 2015. And the court may be familiar from the record that there was the original decree in 2012. Mr. Kodrowski brought a motion to reduce or terminate his spousal maintenance in 2015. And Mr. Vierling and the firm, Eckbert Lammers, represented Mr. Kodrowski at that time. That matter was decided with the court making a finding that Mr. Kodrowski claimed that his income had decreased without disclosing that he had transferred an interest in the company to his wife at the time. In the next round of motions in 2017, there were also similar failures to disclose. The jury verdict of $27 million had been overturned by the trial court in the personal injury matter, but Mr. Kodrowski signed an affidavit 2 days before his appellate brief was due here on the matter and just said that it had been overturned. He never disclosed that he was appealing it. So there have been issues that I do think impact the court's view of Mr. Kodrowski's credibility. When we turn to the issue of his physical functioning, he did have a guardian in the original dissolution proceeding. His father, if I recall, his first name is Len Kodrowski, is a former CFO of Anderson Windows and was involved in the case for a period of time. But I do note, as this court noticed, that there has been no guardian involved in subsequent proceedings. The only fact that's been found in this proceeding regarding his physical functioning is his stipulated agreement that he was capable of self-support. They submitted all these expert reports from the personal injury action in the round of motions in 2017, but if you'll note, those reports are from 2014. And even when we went to court in 2015 and he was seeking to have his maintenance reduced, he didn't disclose them then. So we see those reports now only for the first time in the 2017 motions and after that personal injury action has been going up on appeal. And my understanding is it's been accepted for further review, I believe. I haven't been following that really closely.
Personal injury case?
Yes, regarding the $27 million. Some of the other questions, so those expert reports, while they existed since 2014, they were not produced in the 2015 motion hearings, and we have a 2016 order. So really, you know, the court is to consider information that's occurred since the last court order. They're stale. I don't believe our court gave them any weight. I mean, they were before our trial court, but they're not mentioned in the order. Similarly, this didn't make it into the order, but we did submit to our trial court that Mr. Kudrowski had failed to answer discovery. He failed to disclose whether he was a beneficiary of trusts.
Well, you did indicate that there was non-compliance with your discovery request, but are you trying to say that although the judge didn't find any bad faith, that this is a part and parcel of his attempt to escape paying spousal maintenance?
I guess I don't know if I'd characterize it as attempting to escape spousal maintenance, except that he did not disclose or answer discovery that we needed for that motion hearing. For example, we know that there's a payment made for his car in excess of $580 a month on his behalf, and we have no information about that account. He did not answer whether he's a beneficiary of a trust fund. He would not give actual bank statements so we could determine what other assets he might have. Because the court, at the trial court level, is making an assessment of the relative resources of the parties. So here our trial court knew that there was at least $53,000 in assets that Mr. Kudrowski obtained after his divorce from respondent. But that's where our information stopped. There could be more, and we just brought that to the trial court's attention. Our motion in 2017 was just to deny their request to reduce. We did not affirmatively bring any motions. But we viewed the expert reports as being stale and preceding the last order. So Ms. Kudrowski did not incur expenses of going to the effort of getting an independent medical examination when our trial court had been, our judge had been assigned to this case for years, and we didn't really think that it was a very serious issue. And to that point, I would raise, it's from page 15 of our brief, the fact that they can't complain now that our trial court didn't make a more specific finding about bad faith, because they never gave our trial court the opportunity to review that. They never brought a motion for amended findings. And I do see that the court very thoroughly analyzed motive. The court may have not risen to the level of finding bad faith, but he certainly did analyze it. I'm trying to find the exact page number for you. It starts on page 5 of the order, sort of in the middle of finding 13. And it's true, you know, the trial court found a change of circumstances, but upon looking at, reviewing, and analyzing all the circumstances of this case, the court struggles with what it finds to be the inequities based upon circumstances out of respondent's control. Those equities could be due to poor decisions on petitioner's part, bad faith by petitioner, or just a result of very unfortunate circumstances. However, the court finds itself in agreement with respondent that while petitioner has demonstrated a substantial change in circumstances when viewing the parties' respective circumstances as a whole, in connection with the background that brought them to this point, the court finds that the existing maintenance obligation of $1,800 per month is both reasonable and fair. So it's clear throughout the order that our trial court certainly considered motive. And they're complaining that he didn't go further to say, yes, this is bad faith. I don't think that he even needed to, because there's at least $53,000 in after dissolution assets from which the $1,800 a month could be paid. And this is a spousal maintenance award that will be tax deductible also to the appellant, and so the true cost of it would be somewhat beneath that.
Ms. DeBeer, would you agree with the general legal proposition, and the Krushel case seems to be the one that both parties are referring to, that principal, considering income from the principal property distribution, the general answer is no, you cannot do that. So that, using the burden of proof you're referring to, would be an error of law here unless an exception is found.
True. And I do believe, Your Honor, that we raised a colorable claim of bad faith, because in our motion papers, we did raise all these concerns about the earlier transfer of income and failure to disclose, the failure to disclose that the $27 million verdict was being appealed. We mentioned the failure to answer and disclose throughout the discovery.
Would not this court need to review what the actual findings and conclusions of the judge were? And if at best it's hinted at, but there's no actual finding of bad faith, would that not dictate that reasoning supports the appellant's position, because the court didn't identify a basis to intrude that principal property distribution in order to determine his income?
You're right, Your Honor. And so I would say that the court was very careful to not characterize that property settlement as income. In its finding, the court is very careful to say that it's a property settlement, and it clarifies the other sources of funds that are available to him. So I do think it's enough for the trial court to say that after examining all factors, it would be inequitable, it would be unfair to change it. And based on the equities and the fairness, the court maintains the level, knowing that there's at least the $53,000 in known assets from which to pay the maintenance, and there could be a lot more.
Mr. Baer, I was a little surprised at the way the judge in this matter retained jurisdiction of the personal injury ongoing matter. And I know that you think it's appropriate because of the spousal maintenance, but why would this be any different than someone who is receiving spousal maintenance from 5 years after the fact petitioning to inquire as to increase in assets? You know, maybe you win a lottery, maybe you have inheritance. I mean, why is this so special? Because the judge did, in fact, continue the maintenance amount.
Right, Your Honor. We feel it's appropriate for the court to retain jurisdiction because it's a cause of action arising during the marriage. So the plane accident was actually in 2010. Their divorce was in 2012. The division of any marital component of that asset was never addressed in the decree. So it's clearly an asset that originates from during the marriage. It's no different than parties discovering that there's a pension. I think it was in the Lee case where the wife discovered, oh, there's these other pensions that we didn't know about in the original decree, and the court has the ability to then divide it. So here, the outcome's uncertain. It's not worthy for the parties to put a lot of time and energy into it yet, but it's reasonable for the court to say, it's brought to my attention, there's this additional asset. And again, it's nothing that the appellant complained about to the court through a motion for amended findings. They're raising it for the first time to you. We do believe that this court carefully considered all of the information, and that while he didn't reach a finding of bad faith, our trial court was not required to either, because there are sufficient assets from which Mr. Kodrowski can pay maintenance. And it's clearly an accepted principle that where there's a shortfall for parties, the obligor at times has to pay from personal assets. And we think it's a case that's really more closely aligned to, it's almost identical to that Sieber case, where the husband had an insurance company and he sold it and then claimed that he didn't have the ability to pay maintenance. Now, in the Sieber case itself, back in 1977, that, you know, the Minnesota Supreme Court didn't label it bad faith. It was in later cases, looking back, that other courts said there should be a finding, as in Sieber, of bad faith. But the facts are very similar to Sieber, and again, I would just say that nowhere directly in the Sieber text does it say bad faith. So we think it's similar, and we feel that the court shows in its order that it's carefully considered motive, and it's carefully considered credibility, and that this is a reasonable amount of spousal maintenance. It's basically found that the prong of showing, that burden of proof that appellant has of showing that it's unreasonable and unfair, was not met. And we would also say, too, that once that colorable claim of bad faith is raised, it does become his burden to show that good faith exists. And there isn't a finding in our order specifically finding good or bad faith. There's a court saying it could be a lot of things, but it would be their burden then to bring a motion for amended findings and complain about it and ask for that to be fixed. It would not be ours to do that. I think that just about covers it, unless there's any additional questions.
Apparently not. Thank you, Ms. DeBeer.
Thank you.
Mr. Sandstrom, you get the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm going to ask you a question right away. Ms. DeBeer indicates that you did not raise the issue of the district court retaining jurisdiction over the personal injury amount in district court. Is that, in fact, so?
Well, it was, my understanding, basically just raised it oral argument and discussed it oral argument, and my colleague objected to it, and then the court opted to include that in its order. And so it was included in the court's order. It was argued, it wasn't briefed, and so it wasn't an issue that was necessarily briefed by the parties. But the issue that we raised in our appellate pleadings is that to the extent the trial court terms that as retaining or basically seizing jurisdiction over another cause of action, the issue of court jurisdiction is always appropriate for this court to consider for the first time on appeal. Jurisdictional issues are always before this court and can be considered. And so I think whether or not it was raised at the trial court level or how it was raised or how thoroughly it was raised is not a concern for this court to review the matter. And in terms of that, the sense I get from the court, and I'm in agreement, is that the trial court certainly can reserve jurisdiction over future spousal maintenance issues that may arise once my client, if and when my client obtains those monies. And that's basically what my colleague argued. You can retain jurisdiction over maintenance. That's always appropriate. But you can't seize jurisdiction over this collateral cause of action that's occurring.
I think it may have even created some confusion for the district court to both bring a motion to terminate maintenance and then to acquiesce to a continuance of jurisdiction over the issue of maintenance. But I don't know why the district court said what it said.
Sure, and I think the point of the argument being made by our client in that situation was at that time when the motion was made and the personal injury case has not provided any fruitful funds, that termination of spousal maintenance was appropriate at that point in time. But that if the court wanted to retain jurisdiction to reconsider maintenance in the future, if and when that money came in the door, then it could do that. And so we do believe that the court's statement that it's retaining jurisdiction over that asset's inappropriate, particularly in general, personal injury actions of that sort are non-marital property in any event. And so it's really not an issue of whether or not...
Well, it always depends on what the award's for.
It does.
And I note that in his second marriage dissolution, the court specifically retained jurisdiction over that.
And so I think what the law says is to the extent that the personal injury award it relates to future income, then that future income becomes a component that can be that is marital in character and relates to spousal maintenance.
Well, sometimes those awards are for past wages.
Right. So to the extent the award relates to wages, it's a marital asset. To the extent it relates to pain and suffering, disability, things of that nature, it's non-marital property. And so to the extent any part of it relates to income, then that's going to go back to the issue of spousal maintenance anyway, and so that issue's hypothetically retained to be reconsidered in a spousal maintenance context. And so the court shouldn't seize jurisdiction over the entire pile of $27 million because that's going to lock up all that money in court and really hamper my client's ability to receive compensation for his injuries. It's then on respondent's burden to come back to the court and move for amendment of spousal maintenance issues. And as my time is running out here, I did want to go back briefly to the property settlement issue. I mean, this really, I think, boils down to a matter of law as laid out in the statutes, 518.003. The definition of spousal maintenance under subdivision 3A says, spousal maintenance is payable from the future income or earnings of one spouse for the support of the other. And so the statute specifically says maintenance is only payable from future income, not from property or assets. And so that's the real key issue here and why there was a substantial change in circumstances when my client stops receiving income from that business and then it's basically he's liquidated his asset. The court can't force him to pay maintenance out of that asset. The statute says maintenance is only payable from income. That's a matter of law that this court needs to determine. It's not a discretionary issue where the trial court can just say, well, we feel like making him pay his assets over in support and maintenance. And as far as the finding of bad faith, I completely disagree that my client, once there's no finding of bad faith expressed in the trial court's order, that somehow my client has to go back and ask the trial court to reiterate that there's no finding of bad faith. It's on respondent to go back and move for amended findings on bad faith when there is no finding of bad faith, if that's their basis for asserting that maintenance should continue. And there was no finding of that effect, and respondent failed to re-raise that issue in any sort of request for amended findings or more specific findings. It's not on my client to go back and further enumerate on an issue that the court's already found didn't exist. So I think that's a non sequitur for this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your briefing and your appearance here today to argue in support of your client's position. A decision will be issued in the statutory time frame.